I'm Jed Bodwin. I'm here with Fletcher Powell and Hugo Fan. And this time out, we're going to talk about couples movies.
Our favorite movie, couples. Valentine's Day, of course, right here. So what better time to talk about our favorite couples in the movies? Hugo, I want to start with you because you've chosen a very interesting movie here.
Yeah, the movie I chose is The One I Love, which came out a few years ago. It's directed by Charlie McDowell, who's actually the son of Mary Steenburgen and Malcolm McDowell. So, and it stars Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, and they're kind of like in a rut. You know, they have a troubled marriage. He has done something to wrong her, and they go to a couples therapist who is played by Tan Danson, who sends them to this cabin, like away from everybody. And what they don't know is that this cabin is, there's this weird kind of thing going on in this cabin. And as far as, I don't want to spoil too much. So the furthest I'll go in is probably the end of the first act. What you find out is there's this kind of like house out in the middle of, aside from the cabin that they can go into. And when they go into that cabin, they see their loved one. They have to go in individually. They see their loved one, but it's like this projected version of what they want, you know, out of their loved one. So, you know, they start to, you know, it's kind of this interdimensional, like it says it in the movie, an interdimensional, you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf type thing.
So that's interesting. That has echoes of the Andrei Tarkovsky and also Steven Soderbergh movie Solaris, where what you're seeing in your partner is actually a projection of what of all of the bits and pieces that make up that person in your mind rather than what that person actually is.
You're correct. So yeah, and it kind of, if you watch the movie, it kind of flounders a little bit in the middle towards the end of the second act, but it kind of picks itself up towards the end. So I like the movie a lot. And I think, you know, it's a good, you know, meditation on, you know, who our actual loved ones are and what projections we have of them. So,
yeah, I love this for its strangeness. And again, Mark Duplass pulling this role off amazingly. He's such a joy to watch. And the dialogue is so natural. I would suspect that there's probably some improvisation involved in a lot of the scenes. But it always feels fresh when I see a film with him in it that he's participated in. It's really a joy. And I love that it challenges me as a viewer to sit there and go for a little bit, what in the world's going on? What's happening? And I have to think for just a little bit to kind of catch up and sort of, are my suspicions correct? Aha, I got it. So there's a joy in that. And there's also just a joy in once you figure it out and you start making the recognition and the themes start coming forward. I loved that about this film. And I also have to say that at the end of the film, I could really just smell and taste the bacon. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I mean, like, part of the fun of the movie is just to see the two different versions of Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass and just really kind of, you know, recognizing the difference. And then there's like a little kind of a twist at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That kind of gives the nod to that.
Jed, let's turn to you now because you've chosen a movie that I've loved for a long, long time, Roxanne.
Right. Steve Martin. This is, I think, one of his greatest roles and one of the roles that allows him to show off his versatility as an actor, comedian, everything basically in the package. This, of course, is the story of a man named Charlie who has an extraordinarily large nose. He can't get a nose job because he has an allergy to anesthetics, but he's a very sweet, kind man, well-loved, and he falls for a woman played by Daryl Hannah, who is a graduate student, I believe, in astronomy. She's in his town, and there's a complication. She doesn't love him back. And so he, of course, goes about trying to win her heart in a very unusual way.
Right, because this is a retelling of the story of Cyrano de Bergerac.
Right. And what I love is the way that this is adapted into the late 1980s. I think the material works very well in this adaptation. and the idea that he's writing love letters to her and winning her heart while she thinks it's another man.
A hunky fireman.
Yeah, a hunky fireman who's not especially bright.
No, not remotely.
And so I think it's a wonderful way for Steve Martin to pull off this kind of, I don't think it's necessarily a typical romantic comedy, but it has very strong romantic overtones in it, obviously. And it's just such a joy to watch him dealing with elements from the original Edmund Rostand play, as well as, clearly some of the things that he's brought to the role and to the picture. Especially the scene at the beginning as he's kind of walking around with his tennis racket and sort of making up this song as he goes about his business.
Right, and then of course the scene that nobody can forget, which is is it 20 insults that he
yes.
that he decides he has to come up with for himself during a sort of a what almost becomes a bar fight, but he diffuses the situation by coming up with 20 insults against himself.
Yeah, yeah, and that is one of the elements taken, of course, directly from the play, and it's just such a joy to watch him deal with that scene and those insults, that material, and it really is, I think, one of Steve Martin's finest performances.
I think, you said it earlier, there are some romantic overtones in the movie, and I think the wonderful thing about this movie is it could have, gone in a way where it was a bit too sentimental and a bit too saccharine. But, it's undercut by Steve Martin's writing and the fantastic jokes in the movie.
Yeah, Steve Martin's fantastic. And you may be right that it's not a typical romantic comedy, but it is a romantic comedy. There's no doubt about that. And I think it's a very good example of the genre.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really, I think, also one of those, I hate to use the word timeless, but in many ways, I really believe it is.
Well, and part of that, of course, is being the adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac, which we've seen many, many adaptations, and that one updates it into a time that's a little more familiar to us. And yeah, it really works. Roxanne is a movie that holds a special place in my heart.
So speaking of timeless...
And speaking of movies that are very close to my heart.
Yeah.
The movie I chose is my number one absolute favorite movie of all time, and it's not particularly obscure. It is, however, this little movie called Casablanca. And what I love, I have a soft spot in my heart for failed romances. Uh-huh. And certainly the romance between Rick and Ilsa in Casablanca is one of the all-time great failed romances. You have Rick, who owns a bar in Casablanca, and we can tell has some sort of dark past, but we're not exactly sure what. And then one day, Ilsa shows up along with her husband, Victor Laszlo, and Victor Laszlo leads the resistance against the Nazis. This is all taking place during World War II. And it turns out that Rick and Ilsa had a romance back in Paris, and then one day Ilsa up and just completely disappeared, and Rick never knew why. And she comes back and throws his entire world into chaos. This is a man who has a lot of control over his small world there in Casablanca, and everything gets thrown into chaos. And Ilsa ultimately has to decide between staying with Victor Laszlo, her husband, who's fighting for the resistance, and going back with Rick, who she genuinely was in love with in Paris. And the movie, of course, has one of the great screenplays of all time. You have heard probably 24 lines from that movie over and over, and you may have never even realized they were from Casablanca. But this absolutely is my favorite movie of all time. And so how could I not choose Rick and Ilsa as my favorite movie couple?
Well, I have kind of a question, along with it. What do you think it is ultimately about that film that makes people just return to it, and it becomes, for a lot of people, kind of a point of entry to a more serious type of film?
Well, for me, it's the screenplay. There's no question. It's funny. It's very funny. It's also full of adventure. There are murders. There's intrigue. And then there's this great, great romance between Rick and Ilsa and Victor Laszlo, who's a good guy. It's not like he's kind of scummy and Ilsa has an easy decision to make here. He's a good guy. It's complex. And I think all of those things put together make for what was not expected to be a truly great movie. When it originally came out, it wasn't expected to do much, but it exploded even upon coming out. It won, of course, Best Picture at the Oscars. It's on the top 10 lists of everybody's top 10 lists of all time, as well it should be. And I think it's all of those things for me. Definitely the screenplay, and definitely Ingrid Bergman being shot in soft focus throughout the entire movie. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
I think one of the great things about the movie is it's considered one of the greatest romances of all time, but it's like a failed relationship to start off with, and it's an interesting thing to look at and ponder on.
So some examples of movie couples, some movies for you to watch here for Valentine's Day. Well, another thing, of course, that's coming right up that we thought we'd take a little bit of a look at is the Oscars. We can't really ignore that. Why would we want to? But let's just take a quick look through some of the nominees and talk about what we like and maybe what we don't like about what's happened in this Oscar season. The best place to start, I think, of course, is Best Picture. And I'm going to say that I think it's a pretty dang good list this year.
I agree.
Yeah.
And then, speaking of movie couples, the front runner to many dismay is La La Land. So
I think by many, you might mean me.
Well, you're not alone. There's a growing, movement, that there's a growing backlash against it. But there is also a strong group of people defending it as well.
So La La Land, I want to say up front that I like the movie. I like the movie a fair bit, as a matter of fact. However, I don't think in a year that includes a movie like Moonlight or a movie like Manchester by the Sea that La La Land should be the front runner for the Oscar. It's a very charming movie, but it's, of course, one of those movies that's about Los Angeles. It's about Hollywood, and people in Hollywood sure do love to look at themselves and think of themselves charmingly. But the movie is a nostalgia trip, and for me, it doesn't necessarily bring anything new to the table like Moonlight certainly does. And that takes it back a little bit for me. And what it's doing is it's making me start to dislike a movie that I genuinely liked. And I can't stand it when the Oscars do that to me.
Well, I agree with you that Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea was a better movie. But I think the thing about La La Land is it just feels really good. Like, watching it is like a drug. I've seen it like 5 times.
So that raises a question. I mean, if that becomes the best picture, is that kind of another misstep for the Oscars? When you look at the kind of weightier material in some of the other pictures, and they put that up there, does this become another kind of cry of, well, there goes Hollywood again, just thinking about themselves?
I think absolutely. And it doesn't bother me that it's not necessarily as weighty as the others. I'm not somebody who needs a heavy movie to win Best Picture. But we see time and again examples of Hollywood rewarding themselves. And that's what it feels like to me. Like I said, I like the movie, but it's not Moonlight. It's not Manchester by the Sea. I would even probably take something like Lion or Hidden Figures over La La Land. I think they're all fantastic movies. I just think some of them have more to offer than others.
So what do you think the biggest, if La La Land is kind of an early contender, front runner, what do you think the biggest upset from that list would be if it were to win?
Oh, that would have to be Moonlight. That Moonlight is the only movie that could beat La La Land, I think.
I think that's probably true, that it's the only movie that could beat La La Land. What would be the biggest upset if it would win? Hell or High Water, probably.
Yeah,
I think, which I won't say exactly surprised me that it was on the list, given how well it did critically. But how many people have seen Hell or High Water? Not very many people at all. So yeah, I think in terms of biggest upset, that would probably be the biggest upset. But I agree with Hugo that Moonlight's the only movie that's got a chance to beat La La Land, and I'm really crossing my fingers that that's what happened. I think Moonlight is a transcendent movie. I think, as I've said before, I think it's one of the best movies of the decade, and I don't say that lightly. And to have that get beaten by a nostalgia trip, even as one as lovely as La La Land, it just is going to break my heart.
Gonna break a lot of people's hearts.
Yeah,
February 26th.
Wasn't it just last year? Was it last year that we were talking about how it was kind of slim pickings at this time?
I believe so. And this year, I mean, it really is not. You know, these are all great movies. Arrival, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, I have not seen. That was the biggest surprise to me being put on the list. And then Mel Gibson gets nominated for Best Director for Hacksaw Ridge as well, which was another surprise to me, because a lot of times you only get 5 nominations for director while you get up to 10 nominations for Best Picture. So a lot of times people think that the 5 director nominations are more or less the top 5 in the Best Picture race. And I'm really surprised to see Hacksaw Ridge in that race.
Now, is there anything on this list you would switch out for another movie from last year? I would probably switch out Hacksaw Ridge for maybe 20th Century Women, Silence, or Jackie, because I like those movies a lot more than that one.
I could see trading out Hacksaw Ridge for Silence. I could see just leaving either one of them off altogether. 20th Century Women I haven't seen, but I've heard great things about it. Jackie, of course, I didn't feel quite as strongly about as you did. But I could see just leaving Hacksaw Ridge off entirely and not having as many nominees this year.
It's a very heavy list. And, I think Silence probably, its absence is sort of,
The silence
loud.
Is deafening.
Yeah.
In a way it is. It's a Martin Scorsese prestige picture. Yep. And that's a big deal, especially for Hollywood. And it got no attention whatsoever. And that surprised me. It's a heavy, heavy movie, but it's incredibly well made. And okay.
Also, literally nobody saw that movie.
I mean, the people who saw that movie are sitting in this room right now, and that's pretty much it. But, I think you make a decent case that it very well could have been on here instead of Hacksaw Ridge. So let's just take a look at a couple of these other categories. We've got actor, of course, in a leading role, Casey Affleck for Manchester by the Sea, Andrew Garfield in Hacksaw Ridge. There's another nod to Hacksaw Ridge. Andrew Garfield also in Silence.
He gave a better performance in that movie than he did in Hacksaw Ridge.
And occasionally we see that where an actor will be nominated for one movie when he actually gave a better performance in another movie, and sometimes he wins for the movie that he gave the lesser performance in because people thought he was so good in the movie he didn't get nominated in. I don't know that that's going to happen with Andrew Garfield, but it's something to think about. Ryan Gosling with La La Land, because La La Land is getting nominated for everything this year. Ryan Gosling's incredibly charming in this movie as well. I didn't want to hear him stop talking. Viggo Mortensen in Captain Fantastic. I think that was a surprise to a lot of people. And then Denzel Washington in Fences, who very well could be the front runner here, possibly along with Casey Affleck, who was devastating in Manchester by the Sea.
The front runner is probably Casey Affleck.
You think?
The upset, I think, would be Denzel Washington, who recently won the SAG Award, and upset Casey Affleck for that.
So. I think it's going to go to Denzel. But a really big upset would be Viggo, because Captain Fantastic is a film that, correct me if I'm wrong, did not do quite what people expected critically.
No, it was pretty mixed critically. And the thing that I heard most often from people who saw it who aren't critics was that they really enjoyed it, but boy, was it strange.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's a question too. You know, what do you do with a really fantastic performance in a film that is middling or just above?
Yeah, and well, I think we see that actually in the supporting actor category, which we don't necessarily have to skip to straight away, but let's do it. Michael Shannon in Nocturnal Animals is fantastic.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Boy, was that movie cruddy. I did not enjoy Nocturnal Animals one bit. Except for the one bit named Michael Shannon, and he's great. I was happy to see him nominated. I'd be happy to see Michael Shannon nominated in almost any year. I think the real front runner here, and Hugo, you're probably going to agree with me, is Mahershala Ali for Moonlight.
Yep.
He somehow didn't win the Golden Globe. He lost to somebody who's not even nominated for an Oscar this year, but he's been taking every other award and deservedly so.
Yeah, correct. I mean, Aaron Taylor-Johnson won the Golden Globe, and it was just, when I saw that, I got a text from Fletcher, who immediately turned off the TV at that point.
That's true. That was the very first award of the Golden Globes, and after that, I was finished with the Golden Globes for the night.
And we see Jeff Bridges in that category, which it's good to see him sort of in the mix again. You know, he's somebody who I think we forget how great he can really be.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes back and wows us with a performance. Although, again, he's here in a film that nobody's seen. So
right. Again, Hell or High Water is the one that he's nominated for. But you're right about Jeff Bridges. He pops up, every 5 or so years and gets nominated for something and reminds us how good he can be. Crazy Heart he won for a while back. And I thought he did some of his best work ever in that movie. And so it's nice to see him nominated again. Dev Patel is nominated for Lion. Dev Patel finally looking like a grown up. Well, he has a young face, and he always has, but he really comes across as an adult in this movie, and is really emotionally effective. And then Lucas Hedges, the kid in Manchester by the Sea, who plays very well alongside Casey Affleck.
I think one of the questions people have about this category is, why is Dev Patel nominated for supporting actor and not actor, considering the fact that he's on the poster?
It's a decent question. He's in maybe half the movie. I suppose when it comes to voting, you can never be completely sure, but his production company, my guess is, made the push for him to be supporting actor because they thought it was much more likely he'd get the nomination there than he would in the leading actor category. And you know, he plays a character that's also played by a small child for the other half of the movie. So the case can be made that he is a supporting actor. I can see it going either way. I think it's probably that he was most likely to get nominated in that category, and it worked.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The actress in a leading role category is pretty strong this year. Isabelle Huppert is nominated for Elle, which I don't know that any of us has seen, but she's been getting incredible reviews for that movie.
Yeah. For a movie directed by, was it Paul Verhoeven?
It's Paul Verhoeven, huh?
Yeah. And who's directed what, RoboCop? And it's weird to see a movie directed by somebody like that get critical acclaim.
Paul Verhoeven, yeah, he has an interesting career. We could go off on a tangent on Paul Verhoeven for a while. Let's not. But Isabelle Huppert, and I think she has a great chance of winning just because of what everybody has said about this performance. Ruth Negga is in here from Loving. There's a movie, as a matter of fact, Loving, that I would have put on in place of Hacksaw Ridge on Best Picture. I looking back at the list here, I'm actually surprised that I'm not seeing Loving on the Best Picture list, because I think that was a fantastic movie. Natalie Portman for Jackie, and that's, if I'm not mistaken, Hugo, that's your pick for Best Actress.
Well, it'd be my favorite performance from an actress this year, but I think that the fight would be between Isabelle Huppert and Emma Stone, who, you know, as you know, the tide is going, it's been moving away from Natalie Portman,
mm-hmm.
who won the Critics' Choice Awards but lost the Golden Globe to Isabelle Huppert, and then Isabelle Huppert lost to Emma Stone during the SAG Awards. So I think, you know, it's a fight between Emma Stone and Isabelle Huppert on Oscar night.
Emma Stone, of course, here for La La Land. And then Meryl Streep for Florence Foster Jenkins. I say that as if I should be surprised that Meryl Streep is on here, because she's on here every year. But a lot of people thought that Amy Adams maybe should have been nominated for Arrival. For Arrival. Yeah.
That was a big surprise that she was not on the list for that film.
I would have taken Amy Adams or Annette Bening for 20th Century Women.
Oh,
both
yeah.
of those I thought were better performances, but you know, it's Meryl Streep.
It's Meryl Streep. What are you gonna do? Actress in a supporting role. I only have one name on here that I care about, and her name is Viola Davis. And that's only because I think that Viola Davis should win an Oscar for every movie that she's ever in. From the first time I saw her in Antoine Fisher, where she has an essentially wordless performance that will just put you in tears. And then when I saw her kick Meryl Streep's butt up and down the street in Doubt, I think that Viola Davis is one of our great actresses, and I just want her to win all the awards. Having said that, there are some other pretty strong names on here. Naomi Harris is on here for Moonlight for playing the drug-addicted mother. She's the one who's been getting the most press for her in terms of actresses coming out of Moonlight, even though there are a couple of other really good performances. Nicole Kidman is on here for Lion. Octavia Spencer for Hidden Figures, and then Michelle Williams, who, goodness gracious, is incredible in Manchester by the Sea.
Devastating. She only has, like, what, maybe 10 minutes of screen time, mm-hmm. and she works it, like, the every time she's on screen.
I think we've talked about Michelle Williams a little bit before as mm-hmm. being one of those faces that we don't quite see as much as we'd like to. But maybe that, too, is one of the things that makes her so strong, like a Jeff Bridges, is that she kind of goes away, and then when she comes back, it's like, ah. Oh.
She chooses her roles intelligently, and she's an incredible actress. If it weren't for the fact that Viola Davis's name is on here, and I just want her to win everything, Michelle Williams would be my pick, because I really respect everything that she's able to do. The next gear that she can move into emotionally is something that you rarely see from any actor at all.
Yeah.
Switching just a little bit, we could take a look at the documentary features. This one, it's pretty interesting this time. I just heard earlier a segment on Morning Edition, as a matter of fact, talking about three of these movies in particular. One is I Am Not Your Negro, which is sort of a finishing of writings by James Baldwin turned into a documentary. O.J. Made in America, which is strangely an 8-hour TV documentary that did screen in certain theaters so that it was eligible for the Oscars, but it's essentially an 8-part TV documentary. And then 13th, which is a Netflix documentary looking at racial injustice and especially incarceration throughout the history of the United States, and all of those incredibly powerful documentaries.
Yeah, I'm going to take a leap and say that my excitement is for O.J. Made in America, having spent a good portion of my summer watching it,
oh, yeah.
8 hours at least, and the conversations that came from it. But it's a very smart look at O.J. Simpson, because we all know him as we know him now. And what this does is transports us back, and we sit there as audience members going, okay, well, he seems like such an affable fellow. He seems so likable. And that, of course, is the O.J. Simpson that most people knew before 1994. And then it just explodes everything. And I think it's not sensational. I think it's honest. I think it does what it needs to do. But I would predict I Am Not Your Negro as being probably the winner.
I have not seen I Am Not Your Negro. It hasn't yet played here. But from what everybody is saying, it's incredibly powerful. I think that probably it is between those two, O.J. Made in America and I Am Not Your Negro. But I don't know. Don't be surprised to see 13th sneak in there, because that has been getting incredible press as well.
One of my favorite things about O.J. Made in America is it takes the O.J. trial and O.J.'s career and puts it in context within everything that was going on then, specifically race relations in America. And it was just it's endlessly fascinating. And I felt like it might have been overshadowed a little bit by the People versus O.J., the FX series that came out. But if you get the chance, it's on Hulu right now. It's very good.
Yeah, you can watch it through Hulu. You can also watch it through ESPN right now. Again, 8 hours worth, but very, very, very much worth it.
Yeah, I did both that and the series, the FX series. I couldn't. I felt like I was living in 1994.
Summer
again.
Of OJ for Jed. Well, before we go, maybe let's just take a look through the list and give one pick for something that maybe you were a little bit surprised, but really happy to see show up somewhere throughout the nominations. Doesn't matter where it is, but somewhere throughout the nominations. Jed, go.
Okay. All right. So writing, original screenplay, The Lobster, which Colin Farrell, and a really inventive film, and a film that I was surprised didn't turn up in other places. I think it tended to get lost, and maybe is an example of a picture that might be just too odd for some people, quite frankly, not unlike Captain Fantastic, which we've mentioned. But that's my real joy, seeing that get some wink, nod.
I remember Bob Mondello saying it may not win for best original screenplay, but it would win for most original screenplay.
Right.
For me, something that I'm really happy to see on here is in the foreign language film category, A Man Called Ove, which is a movie that played at the Tallgrass Film Festival this year. And it's not an unusual story. It's about an old man who's cranky and the people around him sort of help him see that he has a heart of gold inside, but it's just really charming. It's incredibly sweet, and I really enjoyed it. And it's always good to see a Tallgrass movie nominated for an Oscar.
I think it has a tough go against The Salesman this year, particularly since the director himself has been kind of, you know, kept out of, well, not kept out, but he's declined going to the Oscars because of the travel ban. So it'll be an interesting thing to watch this year, that category specifically.
Yeah.
One of my favorite surprises is Kubo and the Two Strings, and seeing it being nominated for visual effects. You know, it was also nominated for animated feature, but being nominated for visual effects, you know, makes it like the first animated movie to be nominated since A Nightmare Before Christmas. And it's just the craftsmanship in that movie. Just stop motion is just a lot of work, and it takes years and years to make, and it's just... And it's gorgeous, and I'm glad to see it being recognized.
Yeah, and I actually hadn't even noticed that it was there until you just now mentioned it. But the visuals in that movie are stunning, and to know that it was almost entirely stop motion animation is stunning.
There's a shot at the during the credits of the movie that shows you the scope of everything. You know that how they make it and how they animate everything, and it's really. I kind of just want to sit and just watch them do it. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it really is.
All right.
Well, that'll do it for us this time around. Let us know your picks for the Oscars. Go to our Facebook page, tweet us at KMUW, send us an email at info@KMUW.org. We'll wrap up the KMUW Movie Club for this time around. For Jed Bodwin and Hugo Fan, I'm Fletcher Powell.